The following episode largely revolves around bipolar disorder, suicide, and dealing with the grief of the aftermath. Listener discretion is strongly advised, so please feel free to either move on to a different one or turn it off at any point if it gets too much. Welcome to Progress Not Perfection, the leadership podcast where we grow through what we go through. My name is JQ, and I'll be your co-pilot. Each episode, we sit down with leaders to explore how they build companies and communities, products and services, with a vision for the greater good. We dig into how they create clarity in chaos as they wrestle with messy situations, and also how they navigate their own career journeys along the way. If you're ready, let's step to it. On March 14th, 2019, Maddie Millsap's sister, Rachel, died by suicide. 8 months later, in November 2019, Maddie launched Adventures Unabridged, a personal blog to talk about her grief journey and shed light on mental health and bipolar awareness. Maddie is a friend from work, and the more I dug into her writing, the more I knew her story had to be shared. Her description of her blog aptly describes where we're going. These are the raw, gritty, honest accounts of my adventures through life, love, and loss. Each adventure has its own tumultuous arcs that are meant to be shared, revisited, savored, and reflected upon. This is my life, the glorious ups, the gut-wrenching downs, and everything in between.
It was March 14th, 2019, last year, so just over a year ago, and we found out that my sister had died by suicide. It was a very long day, and I think maybe part of helping to share the context of suicide is helping you understand where I wasn't that day. You know, when we found out that my sister had died by suicide, we had been myself at work, my husband at work, my mom and dad on their 30th anniversary trip to Fino, and my sister and her friends trying to get into contact with her. It took about, from the moment we kind of knew something was wrong, it took about 6 hours of sitting and hoping and, you know, running through every other scenario that could have happened for it not to have been suicide before we actually found out. And I think it was particularly challenging for me because when my sister did die, I was actually supposed to be with her the next day. So 3 days prior to her death, we had been together all day, snowshoeing together. She was supposed to stay at my house that week, but we had just gotten a new couch and she would have had to bring the kittens, and we didn't want the cats to scratch the kittens. the kittens to scratch the couch. Right. And so she ended up being kind of home alone in a time when she was struggling. And to us, you know, we didn't know she was struggling at that point in time, but of course she did. And so it was an incredible shock. And as you mentioned, my sister, she suffered throughout kind of 5 years of her life. The last 5 years of her life, she was learning to live with bipolar. Bipolar is a disorder, a mental illness that's marked by really extreme shifts in mood. So at one end of the spectrum, there's an extremely elevated mood or high known as mania. And on the other end, there's a very dark, despairing, and unbearable depression. And so my sister, over the course of these 5 years, was going through them in cycles. And for the most part, learning to live with it very, very well. You know, there's no cure from bipolar, but there's ways to manage it. It was, you know, a moment that she saw no more hope. And I think that's what's most sad about suicide, is that it can happen so quickly and all it has to be is a moment, you know, and that's what's so gut achingly, excruciatingly painful about it, is that, you know, that person wanted to live. And my sister loved life. And she would breathe life into other people. She was so iridescent and authentically beautiful and creative. It was so traumatizing because she was like one of the beautiful people in the world, you know?
Yeah. Thanks for starting to walk us through this. Tell me, you've kind of dug into this a little bit. Tell me a little bit more about Rachel. What was she like?
Yeah, well, she was my. It's so cool because I smile when you ask that, and I'm so glad that I smile because there's been a lot of time where it's been really hard to talk about my sister just because it hurts so much. But she was my little sister, so I'm a middle child. We have an older brother, and she was always off in her own little world. So she was always one of the people that was dancing and singing and writing her own plays. And we always used to joke as a family that the world needed a little more of Rachel. And so to lose her was heartbreaking because the reality that the world would always need more Rachel. And so she added a lot to our family. And I think that it was quite a great loss to not have her by our side in this world anymore. And what she was really beautifully exceptional at was writing. When she died, and we found 15 journals in her room. A lot about it, of it was kind of the pain that she was going through, but a lot of it were these really beautiful illustrative observations about the world and these unique insights that, a lot of us hadn't seen before. So it wasn't till, I think, at least for myself, and I can't speak for my other family members, I didn't realize how exceptionally talented she was, especially from a writing and poetry perspective, until I was sitting there after her death, moving through her journals and just ferociously going through them and trying to connect with her.
I love the fact that you bring up how she was a writer, and in this really beautiful way, you're a writer too, and you capture words very well, very eloquently. As I was browsing through your blog, there's this one quote that you have from Rachel. It says, "You are important," the world whispered to everyone, and for once, everyone heard it, because we are here, we are important. What does that quote mean to you?
For me, it's about the reminder that, just being here is enough. And I think that when you're struggling with mental health or when you're struggling with mental illness, that is so important to recognize that, releasing expectations of who you're meant to be, of who you are, is one of the kindest things that you can do. And so for me, it's about recognizing that no matter what got you here, no matter where you're going right here, right now, who you are is most important. Oftentimes we don't hear that, right?
Yeah. You've started to paint this picture of how Rachel wrote plays and was creative and wrote, journaled a lot and wrote poetry. Tell me maybe a bit about what she was like in high school, maybe from the point of view of one of your favorite memories of her in high school, or both of you.
We have a number of great memories. My sister and I were very, very close, best of friends in high school. So, to give you context, when she was in grade 9, I was in grade 12, and she would hang out with me and all of my friends through school. And I think something that really represents who she was and who she is we did musical theater together. And she
Oh,
really
cool.
wanted, And so one year we were doing Les Mis. It was our universe or was our high school play.
Classic.
And
So
absolutely.
good.
And she so wanted this one role. She poured her heart into it and she was so capable of it. But you know how casting goes. Sometimes you just don't know the decisions behind it. And she was so devastated about, not getting the role that she wanted. But instead, she was given, four different kind of chorus roles that were very, very distinct. And it didn't matter that she didn't get the role that she thought she wanted. She just charged into each of those four small kind of side roles and just delivered them with so much exuberance and passion and excitement that you just couldn't take your eyes off of her. She just had this ability to, even with the smallest, in the smallest way, in the smallest opportunity, just making people laugh and feel and cry. And I think that really, really encapsulates who she was and, my favorite pieces of her. And so we were always together, doing so much together.
That's so awesome. She sounds like she was such a powerhouse, which is so cool. You mentioned that she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and type 1, right, in 2014 in her 12th grade year, and then had that and dealt with it for 5 years. What was that like? What do you remember that period being like?
Yeah, so when she was diagnosed, the reason she was diagnosed was that she was very in tune with herself, and she realized that, something in her brain was not right. So she noticed a change. And of course, I can only speak about it from not her viewpoint, of course. But she actually sought out help. So she went to her counselors. They took her to the hospital, and she ended up having a full-on psychosis episode. So people with bipolar, what can happen is on kind of the mania spectrum, they can move into a psychosis. And psychosis is a little bit different for everyone who experiences it. And I only know based on what she's told me. But when you're in psychosis, you start to have a lot of hallucinations and delusions, and your reality becomes altered. So, you have auditory hallucinations, you hear things, you see things, but then everything around you, from the perspective of what the world is, starts to change. So, for my sister specifically, her major delusion when she went into a psychotic episode was that the world was undergoing a purge, and there were good people and bad people, good people who would save her, and bad people who were trying to hurt her or kill her. And so when she was in a psychosis state, which in her shortest one was about a week, in her longest one, we believe it was about a couple months, her whole reality is that the world is undergoing that purge.
That's so
Incredibly
terrifying.
frightening. Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people don't understand, that that is the reality. So people act, as you can imagine, incredibly uncharacteristically, and go through all these different types of mood of anger and fear and screaming and yelling because they're in a different reality, right? And so I never saw my sister in a full-blown psychosis. The year that she was diagnosed, my then boyfriend, now husband, and I, we were in Copenhagen on an international exchange. And my parents actually told me over video chat that my sister was in the hospital. And I think at that point, I just didn't understand. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what they meant by psychosis. I didn't know what they meant by her being in the hospital. And when I came home, I definitely didn't know, what it meant to be out of the hospital, but to now be diagnosed with bipolar. And so when someone is diagnosed with bipolar, one of the ways they talk about it is, every person has a cup, and your cup fills based on the different stressors that you have in your life. And so as long as your cup doesn't overflow, you're probably okay. You can manage your bipolar, you'll have mood swings, but you can manage. But if there are too many stressors and that cup overflows, that's when you may enter a psychosis. So for my sister, it was all about managing her stressors and figuring out how to make sure that her cup wouldn't overflow.
Yeah, and that's something that, I imagine would be really tough to monitor too, right? Like to not over manufacture it either and just try to have her live out her life without being super conscious of all of that either. That must be tough. Being hyper aware of what stresses her out and not.
Yeah, absolutely. And she came out of her first psychotic episode, and she just crushed it. She graduated high school. She took a year off so she could work and do what she needed to do. And then she went to university, and she did a full semester of university, and she was getting incredibly good grades. And she ended up being in a car crash. And that, as I'm sure people who have been in a car crash before, that is a huge stressor and a real big emotional stressor. So she ended
How
up,
old was she at that time?
she would have been 19.
Okay.
Yeah. And so at that moment, that was what we believe was the start of the next psychotic episode. She had one more the year before she died, but she really was a warrior, and she was open about her diagnosis, what she was struggling with, and how she was moving through it. And she wanted other people to know that they could move through it too, and they could go to school, they could do the job they want to do. Her only goal was to help people understand that they can get through this too.
Yeah, I feel like when you're hit by something, you could either just let it completely overwhelm you. I'm not sure how much you know about my own story, but I'm a cancer survivor. And so having to deal with that in the past, it's like in the hospital, you can clearly see people who just kind of like let it overwhelm them to the point where they give up. And it sounds like your sister was actually very much the opposite of that, where she accepted that she had bipolar and then, to your point, was a warrior in terms of trying to champion her way through that, not just for herself, but also for others, is what I'm hearing. You've just passed the first year mark, and sounds like a year of hell, to be honest. And it sounds like over the past year, you've processed your sister's suicide in different ways. What was the last year like for you in terms of grieving and healing? Yeah, maybe let's start there.
Yeah, it was quite honestly entirely excruciating. And it's a year away now, and it's still, and I'm sure yourself included, when you've lost people, that wound is very raw for a very long time, and maybe not every day when you get a year away from it, but it's still there, and that pain is so prominent. I remember a few weeks ago, I was sitting with my husband, though, on kind of what you referenced as what was this last year for us, and I remember sitting there and telling him, you know, I'm so proud of this last year. And I like caught myself because I'm thinking, you know, how can you be so proud? Like, that's the word you choose. Like, where does that come from? And I think it comes from, you know, what you were speaking about. It takes a lot of gusto and courage and determination and, you know, getting back up off your feet after you fall down 100 times to face something. And so I think that pride came from the place of knowing that every day that I could, and I couldn't every day, but every day that I could wake up and face it head on, straight looking at my grief and saying, how are we going to do this? I was so proud of that, being able to look back at the year and saying, you know, I took that time off and asked myself, what makes me happiest? And I started there. And then from that, I started to process it all through writing and then through sharing my writing and then just slowly, slowly, slowly chipping away at finding some way to flourish, not despite the grief, but with it, and recognizing that it permanently reshapes you and whether you want it to or not. And so there's an opportunity to look at it and say, how have I reshapen, and what parts of that are good and what parts of that are bad?
I love the fact that you bring up that statement that you said, how do we make sure, or how are we going to work through this with, and we being yourself in grief, right? And what you were alluding to. It's very forward looking, you know, it's in the present, right? It's how are we going to get through this, but it's for purposes of the future too. You touched on writing as your outlet. Could you tell me a little bit more about what it was like finding that outlet for you?
What I noticed after she died was that there were all of these thoughts, just these singular thoughts that were flying through my mind. And as soon as they would fly through my mind, I would lose them. I couldn't re-grab that thought. I couldn't pull it back out of my mind again. And they were so insightful and they were so interesting. And they were thoughts that you could only think if you've been that close to death. So it would be things related to, you know, what we experienced in that day, in that week, what we experienced when, you know, when you see your dead sister's body or things like that. In that moment, all these thoughts come through your mind, but you can't bring yourself back to that point. So what I started doing was I started writing them just in my phone notes, just half sentences of things that I was experiencing that I was so afraid to lose. I was so afraid to lose these thoughts. And for months and months and months, I would just write them down on a single notepad in my phone. I couldn't sleep unless I did it. I couldn't finish grocery shopping unless I did it. I had to do it right away. And I found that when I took them out of my brain, And when I put them somewhere, what happened was it like released my mind. I wasn't scared anymore. I had them somewhere. I could look back on them. I could look back 2 months down the road and see, wow, look at the progress that's happened over time. And I can see it. Whereas if you're just feeling it, you can't always give yourself, you can't always give yourself credit for that process. And so I was writing all these thoughts down, but you know, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, well, do I keep them to myself? And I don't know if that thought came through my head explicitly, but I started to share some of my sister's poetry. You know, my own thoughts were only half sentences, but hers were really thoughtful and insightful. So I went on some trips and all my photos from my trips had a piece of her poetry. And so I was actively kind of selecting pieces of her poetry that really resonated with my grief. The big reason for it was that I wanted to make sure that people around our family knew that it was okay to grieve publicly or in whatever way that they needed to grieve. I think when death happens, a lot of people in a community look towards a family to see what's appropriate in grief. And I wanted to make sure, especially since my sister was so, so young, and I'm so young, and my friends are young, and her friends are young, that they too could speak about it if they needed to. And so for me, that was the very first piece of it. I needed to speak about it, but what if they needed to speak about it too? And I just wanted them to know that it was okay. And I found that as they started to share about it too, it helped me be seen too. You know, it was like we were having these little nuanced whispers to each other that made us recognize that we were all in pain together, but we weren't alone in it. And it was really, really powerful. But what I found kind of as I got further away was that I could start turning some of those small thoughts I had at the beginning into much more detailed accounts of what I was going through. And so I started writing them because when you're grieving, you know, you feel incredibly isolated. And all I wanted was for someone to understand pieces of it, the small pieces that are hard to articulate, that people might not know the thought that goes behind them or the pain that goes behind them. Mm-hmm. And so I started sharing them. You know, I started writing about what that day was like for our family when we found out. I started writing about what it is like, think about, you know, what do we do with my sister's clothes and do I wear them? And I started to write about, you know, my sister was a couple days away from getting a tattoo that was supposed to remind her to live. And I started really explicitly, you know, writing these kind of harrowing tales of what it's like to be right with grief right now. And I kind of started wading into that place of vulnerability where I started sharing them on social media. And it really was out of desperation at first. I just wanted to be seen. It sounds really selfish. It felt really desperate to me at first, but I was just overwhelmed by the response about people who had been through grief and who had not been through grief, who had lost their siblings or their parents. And they started reaching out to me and I was, you know, really overwhelmed because I knew that my stories were raw and reflective and thoughtful. But what I didn't recognize was that they were also relatable. It was quite a shock when I got such a positive response from people. And that's where I started to kind of understand the value in being open. And it, you know, it wasn't just about me being open. It was about the realization that, you know, vulnerability is contagious. You know, if we crunch through vulnerability, we're able to gain agency over our own story by putting it out there.
Yeah, you have this piece around like the more you share, the more you heal together, right?
Yeah, yeah.
A friend's sister committed suicide a few years ago. I want to say it was around like 2015, 2016. And for me, experiencing that for the first time as a friend just showing up, right? I didn't know what to do at the funeral or how to be there for her afterwards. And one thing that's right in my face right now is this piece that you're sharing about finding community in trauma, right? Where the vulnerability of you sharing and opening up then has transitioned into more people being comfortable with opening up themselves. vice versa, back in high school, out of my friend group of like 6-7 of us, like three of us, we'd each lost our dads, like one after another in the span of like 2 years. And I don't think we've ever really like talked about it, you know, to this day, even apart from being very much like, hey, you know, if you ever need me, I'm here kind of thing. Because I don't think when we were that age, I don't think like we were 15, 16 years old, right, when it happened. And so going through all of that death, all of that all at once, we all had kind of dealt with it in our own ways, but pretty individually, I'd say, despite being in a very tight group. Looking back at loss, it's like, wow, as tough as it is to open it up, there's something very transferable in sharing what you're processing.
And so I'm curious, Jay, when you look at the loss that you faced in your life and now, you know, seeing your friend go through it as well, how has that shaped your reaction to other people's losses?
I think it's still so tough because I guess like it doesn't really ring as true until like it's really personal, if that makes sense. And what I mean by that is, let's take coronavirus as a great example. I think there's a bit of apathy towards what's going on. Like it even started off as a joke, right, to most people in terms of memes being created. And there's a bit of insensitivity that was in social media surrounding it at the start. And then as it got more and more serious, I think there's this realization that, holy crap, especially when it hit like the North Vancouver seniors home. And then everyone's like, oh, it's here. It takes on this shape of becoming so real because then it's like, what about the elders and seniors in my life, right? And you start to, what if that's my mom? And I think at that point, it's where it gets really personal. But when it's a friend's, for example, going back to my friend's sister's suicide, I think there's still like a level of like disconnection where it was shocking and I didn't know how to react and I didn't know how to be there at the time, but I wanted to. When it's at a general level, we don't talk about it in a way that is very helpful, which is kind of why I wanted us to do this episode, because it was like, if we get raw, maybe at some point there's this human condition that like switches where, you know, we see each other for like what the other person is really going through. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think it's really interesting what you speak of with COVID as well, because, you know, I sat, especially the first days, you know, when everything was completely unknown, and it still is, but there's a little bit more understanding of what's happening. And I was sitting there and I was just in tears because, you know, we've lost someone so recently in our immediate family that I can preemptively feel what it would be like to some extent, even just a sliver of losing my mom or my dad. And you know, it's so painful. And if you've experienced it, it's right there and it's in your face. But unless you've experienced it, it's hard to understand. And, you know, I told someone once, someone came to me and they said, you know, I wish I understood. And I said, I really, really would never wish that understanding on you, because the only way you get to that level of understanding is to lose someone. Yeah. And it's so painful. And I would never wish that on anyone. Mm-hmm. I also thought it was interesting what you mentioned when a friend goes through it. And I think it's interesting because, you know, I was talking to my mom about my sister's, you know, mental health that she was living with. And I said to my mom one day, I said, you know, Rachel, she never gets a break from that mental health. So even for us as family members, you know, she'd be at my mom and dad's house sometimes, she'd be at our house sometimes. And even for us as people who were outside of her mental illness and outside of the direct impact of mental illness, it was exhausting and it was challenging for us to help her through it. You know, it's a whole nother thing to be someone who is in it, mm-hmm. right? Who never mm-hmm. gets to take a break from their mental illness. And I think it's similar with grief, you know. If your friend goes through something and loses someone, they are stuck with that grief every single moment of every single day. And you, as someone who is a step removed from that, mm-hmm. you have these moments where you can forget about it. And it's very similar. And there's just a lot of parallels to even people with mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's so hard to know how to support someone.
It's totally so hard because it's not like there's a class, you know, in high school where it's like, oh, here's how we're going to deal with this.
No.
That's not a thing. We've talked about finding your outlet. We've talked about finding community in trauma. Let's maybe shift gears a bit to maybe letting go, if applicable at all. What did that look like for you?
Yeah, I think that when you experience loss, kind of the world comes crashing down all at once. And you're trying to grab all these pieces and hold on to them and put them together and keep them close. But at some point you start to realize that maybe it's just easier if I kind of let this big tidal wave carry me downstream. It's going to be scary and it's going to be hard, and I'm going to want to try to swim upstream and get back to who I was before I got washed down here. But in a lot of ways, it's so much easier just to let go and start again downstream. And so for me, a lot of that was around, letting go of what I had previously wanted in my life and realizing that, this will change it. A lot of it had to do with letting go of control over my emotions. It was kind of very quickly that I learned, any given day I could wake up and feel anything, and it won't be my fault. It won't be because of something I did or something someone else did. It's just, it will rush over me in a way that I can't explain and no one can explain. And it was about letting go and realizing, like, this is just the process. And I just need to let it take me, and I need to be okay with that, and it'll get better. I think the other aspect of letting go that was really hard was letting go of wanting to help everyone else in my family through it, which is probably the hardest thing that I had to let go of and still have to let go of on a daily basis. And when you go through trauma as a family, which is, it's very different pros and cons in comparison to going through a trauma alone. But when you go through a trauma as a family, everyone is hurting from the same thing, but in a different way. So I would sit there and, I knew, like, deep in my bones that I will get through this. I will find a way. But it scared me to think that, my mom or my dad or my brother wouldn't get through it. For people familiar with suicide, the first stuff you start to Google after you've gone through suicide is a whole bunch of stuff about suicide. And so it was kind of planted in my head that if someone commits suicide in or dies by suicide in your family, that it increases the likelihood of another person dying by suicide. And I was so frightened. And so what I wished I could have done was, take my mom's pain, take my dad's pain, take my brother's pain, put it all within the visibility of my own mind and my own arms and just run through it for them. But you can't. And it's really hard to realize that and to come to terms with that, the best thing that I can do for the rest of my family is to actively manage my own grief. And the best thing my mom can do is actively manage her grief. Otherwise, we're worrying about each other and then we're both not healing. And so it's taken a really long time. I'm very, very, very privileged to have a family who is kind and who is open and who, we didn't fall apart through this. And I know that that's not often the reality. This grief can tear families apart. And so I just feel so privileged to still have what's left of my family as one unit, loving, caring, respectful.
It's so good that you guys are leaning into each other instead of, you know, pulling away, because that's very possible. You mentioned that you had to let go of yourself in terms of who your future self would be, you know, because now things are different, right? Like you're not gonna maybe what you had pictured, for example, with you and your sister doing something a year from now or a trip that you had planned. That being an example of like how that wouldn't happen in the future. What was the rebuilding process like for you?
It started with giving myself space. So because I had let go of things, because I was incredibly fortunate to have a company that kind of supported giving me extended time off, I had the space I needed. And so for me, I was sitting there thinking, how do I possibly do this? How do I push through this? You know, knowing where to start is sometimes the hardest thing to figure out. And so I kind of looked back at my life and, you know, before this, as much as the before me felt so far away. And I said, what makes me happiest? Where am I happiest? Where have I found happiness in my life before? Because, you know, with death, it really convinces you that you'll never feel happiness again. For me, my happiness has always been in the outdoors. So I grew up an avid ocean kayaker. My dad and I used to go on multi-week trips out west coast of British Columbia, you know, and that's really the oceans and the mountains and the trees, just being in nature and feeling so small in this big, big world was always really, really comforting to me. So I decided that with, you know, my time off, and I took 5 months off of work, I decided that, you know, 80% of my time would just be in the outdoors. And most recently, I'm an ultra marathoner, a trail runner. Every chance I could get, I would be in the mountains and doing treks. And I did my first solo backpacking trip. And it was so hard at first. Like, I wish I could say, oh, I got on the trail and everything was perfect. I was back in my place and it was great. But, you know, it took hundreds and hundreds of kilometers of running and hiking before I felt anything again. You know, you're so numb. I remember this really distinct moment on the Sunshine Coast Trail. We had been hiking for, you know, 40 kilometers that day, and we came out and it was this indescribably beautiful mountainscape that we kind of popped out to. And I just remember bursting into tears and just wailing because I was looking at it and I couldn't feel anything. I was looking at these beautiful mountains and I knew they were beautiful, but I felt nothing. And to me, that was the scariest thing, to think that this numbness would carry on for the rest of my life. But I just kept hiking and kept running and kept moving forward. And every now and then, as the months moved on, there would be a little glimpse of something happy, or a little glimpse of some contentment, or, you know, my legs didn't feel like lead, you know? And so it was just about going back to basics. What's made me happiest? And I just filled all of my time with that. And it seems really simple, but it was really, really challenging. And scary too, because if I can't find happiness here, how will I trickle it down to other places in my life?
Yeah, wow. That must have been so much in terms of rebuilding your foundation by being outdoors and finding yourself really again. You mentioned the Sunshine Coast Trail. In your blog, you say, on this final day of the climb, I met my darkness. What did you mean by that? Was that tied into how you just didn't feel anything, despite being surrounded by beauty?
Yeah. Oh, I almost laugh at that piece hearing it now, because it was so painful. It was so painful. We had been hiking all day. We didn't want to be there anymore, you know, and it was just like we were moving our feet and it just felt like we weren't getting where we needed to go, which is often in parallel, very similar to what you feel with grief. I think my darkest personal thoughts were on that trail. Because on that trail, which was the Sunshine Coast Trail, was my first trek after my sister passed away. And it was about 6 weeks later. And I was very much believing that if I got on the trail, I'd be good. It would be it. Everything would melt away. And it was just the complete opposite. I was just in pain the whole time. And so on this mountain climb, you know, the outdoors strips you of everything. So I was stripped open, raw, and then all these dark thoughts were coming through my mind about how this would never change. And, you know, if my husband got hurt on this trip, it would be all my fault and I would be responsible for his death. And it was just this really big spiral. And then we got through it. You know, he came out the other side and he said, okay, that is the worst I have felt. and I got through it. And it's about like looking that darkness and saying, okay, is that all you got for me? Like, you know, that was extremely painful, but I got through it. So is that all you have? And it just felt like in that moment and in that trip that that was like the deepest darkness that I would face. And in a weird way, as painful it was in that moment, it was incredibly comforting because it almost felt like I could breathe, like I could take a second, like I could recognize that I won't get everything out of this trip, but at least I've seen an incredibly painful piece and I can keep moving forward now.
Thanks for sharing that. The reason I wanted to bring that in was because when we were talking about how to prepare for this, you had highlighted a piece around staying the course, but you were talking about how you weren't sure how to articulate it. I don't know. I thought it was funny because you're a trail runner and that would have been like it totally you, right? Where seeing the course through, meeting your darkness along the way, right? And yet despite that, coming out the other side. Although you were talking about how you couldn't find a way to articulate it, I actually felt like that was exactly it, right? The trail running, the facing everything head on. And so we've covered a lot from rebuilding foundations to finding your outlets and community to staying the course. I'm curious, what do you miss most about Rachel?
It's hard because essentially it says everything. I think I miss feeling like our family is whole. You know, when you lose someone, there's always an empty chair. There's always someone who's not in your family chat. There's always someone not on the road trip. There's fewer presents at Christmas. There's all these holes, and it's not all these holes. It's the same hole, and it's a lack of fullness. And I think that's what I miss most. And it's hardest because that will never change. There will always be a hole, and we will always see that hole. And with that kind of hole and with going through trauma, you lose a lot of your innocence. You lose a lot of your carefree demeanor. But what you gain when you have a hole is you gain so much appreciation for what's left, even though you weren't able to save what you had. You see the world through such a different lens, and you soak all the light in so much deeper. And so I definitely miss most that without her, I do not feel whole. But she has given me so much, and I am so thankful that my world is so much bigger now, which feels so terrible to say. It's a terrible thought to feel like there's a benefit from someone who dies, but it really is. It's just burst my world wide open, and I feel so much more love, and I feel so much more fullness, and that's because of her. And sometimes I like to think that it's because I've kind of taken on and consumed all the traits of her that made her the best person she was. And I try to be like her and try to see the world through her eyes, which I never would have done if I hadn't lost her. And so yeah.
It's weird hearing this because I kind of feel like I'm talking to myself in some ways, because when my dad died, it was, I don't know, I keep on coming back to this idea that the fact that we're here, and my dad being someone who like made the most out of his life, so he was blind. Despite that handicap, he was like, well, you know what, Jay, like there are a lot of things that blind people can't do. You know, you can't drive and you can't become a surgeon, but for everything else, like go for it. You know, and I often like ask myself, where does drive come from in terms of why are some people doing some things, right? Like going all in and trying to make the most out of it. And I think a lot of it does have to do with, unfortunately, like grief and loss, because that was such a trigger point for me where it was this realization that I'm going to grasp onto what I have in terms of what time I have here, right? And just run like all out. I feel you.
And what I know of you as well is that you live with so much vibrancy and drive and determination. And when I spoke about, you know, being proud of my last year, it's because the life that was put into last year as a result of death, it was very much more than I had, you know, lived in comparison to you know, the combination of 3 or 4 years prior. I completely agree with you, and I completely echo your sentiment. And
we're here to make it count now, you know.
That's it. That's all we can do.
This is really good. Let's wrap. I'm curious, what are your hopes with Adventures Unabridged?
What are my hopes? Oh, the big question. You know, I started it because I needed a place to talk about grief. Mm-hmm. I needed a place to capture everything, but I didn't want it to be bounded to grief. I wanted it to be an account of my life, right? And so that's why it's called Adventures Unabridged, because I never wanted to only talk about grief. I wanted to use what I learned from grief and my articulation of grief to also talk about the different adventures and the different treks and the different plans that I get to do in my life. And at this time, it's still just for me. And I know it helps other people, and other people have found a lot of comfort in reading it, but it's really, really just for me. I like having the opportunity to know that my life has been captured somewhere. And that, you know, if people have read it, we're already connected on such a level. The first time we meet, then we could be connected through hours of conversation. I like to think that for me, it's a really great way to keep reminding myself how far I've come and what I've battled through, and that I can do all this despite it all. Yeah, but I don't really have plans for it. It's just
doing it
my outlet for now. Yeah. What are your plans with this podcast?
I think it's the same answer. Yeah. You know, I feel like I'm a robot a lot some of the times, because I execute really well and I focus a lot on that. And so sometimes that can make me pretty selfish, I think, as a human. And so part of going through this is all almost this search for developing empathy. I don't know if you've heard of the dirt hole theory, but here we go. It's where you realize that there's this weakness, and let's say it's a dirt hole. And so you start to try to like patch it in by shoving dirt and covering it with a shovel, right? A simple example would be like, if you're overweight, you might start exercising and working out. But then because you continuously attack it with so much dirt and you keep on packing it on, it eventually becomes this mound where once was a hole, right? Where you have now made it from a weakness into a strength. And so I don't think I'm there yet with empathy. I think I'm very much still learning. But this podcast, every single episode, really, it puts me into the shoes of other people from a perspective of things that I wouldn't normally know, you know, or would have never maybe considered in the past. And so I think it's just continuing to live life with curiosity. That's so important for me, that I don't lose that sense of wonder the older I get, because I think it's easy for me to be like, oh, I know everything. I'm so smart. And it's really taking like a hammer to my ego, which I think can get way too inflated sometimes, and saying there's a lot I don't know with each of these topics. This one being a great example. How do I just shut up and listen for a while, you know? So, and thank you for asking that. Maddie, thanks so much for hanging out with me. I know how tough it is to open up, and how much difficulty it was originally dealing with it and being like, do I do this? Do I do this podcast at all? So thank you for trusting me enough to jump into this.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for thinking of me and giving me a platform to share my story and my family's story and the pieces we know of my sister's story. I really appreciate it.
Where can people find Adventures Unabridged?
Yeah, so they can find it at www.adventuresunabridged.com. I also share a whole bunch of my content and more than just my blog on my Instagram, which is just at Madeline Millsip.
Regardless of what you're dealing with in life, I think this conversation was a strong reminder that, one, just being here is enough. And two, you and I are loved by others, regardless of whether people say it or not. If you need to talk to someone, you can reach the crisis text line by texting HOME to 686-868 or calling Crisis Services Canada at 1-833-456-4566. Those are Canadian numbers, and if you're American, you can reach the crisis text line by texting SHARE to 741-741 or calling the National Suicide Prevention Line at 1-800-273-8255. To honor Rachel's writing, I asked Maddie if she would be open to sharing one of Rachel's poems, so we'll leave you with this.
I learned that it has no name, so I call it temporary. Anchor myself in love instead. Look to the trees who brave new seasons with the same branches, who live new seasons with fresh leaves.